Hi, Steve.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing?
Pretty well.
Good. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright of Blind Hits TV. You are Stephen Walt, possibly best known as the co-author of the controversial book, The Israel Lobby. However, unbeknownst to some people, long before you were widely known for that, you were known in international relations circles. You're a professor at Harvard, and you were known in international relations circles as a realist. And I wanted to talk about that today because I think you've been known to complain that there's not enough of a realist perspective governing American foreign policy sometimes. And that presumably includes some of the stuff that's happening in the Middle East, and a lot of stuff is happening in the Middle East. Although I might add, President Obama is said by some to be a realist. I'm not sure how you feel about that, but there is a claim that realism is abundantly represented in the White House. But anyway, I wanted to talk about realism, what it is, how it shapes a person's view of the world, and how it is shaping your view of what's going on.
Sure.
Okay. So you tell us, what is realism, not in the, you know, everyday sense, but in the technical sense in international relations?
Among scholars of international politics, realism is an approach or a body of theory about how international politics works. It puts states at the center. It sees them as the most important actors. And it sees the situation that states face as different than other forms of politics because there's no world government that can protect different countries from each other. States live in a world of anarchy. That doesn't mean chaos. That simply means, for IR theorists, that there is no central authority that can keep states from fighting. And that means it's a self-help world. Each state is ultimately out for itself, has to worry about its own security. And that means power is really important for realists. The distribution of power, maintaining balances of power, is central to what drives international politics. So realists tend to be wary of big idealistic or ideological crusades. We tend to think of world politics as being very heavily driven by power considerations and by security concerns. And it's not to say that these things are the only things that matter or that realists don't care at all about morality or ethics, but we tend to see most of foreign policy as driven by self-interest. And we think that if you lose sight of that fact, if you start paying relatively little attention to security or you stop worrying about the balance of power, you're likely to get yourself into real trouble. One final just point about realism is there have been a number of prominent realists in the history of American foreign policy. Henry Kissinger is usually seen in that light, George Kennan, Walter Lippmann as well. People like that didn't agree on everything, but they tended to have a rather pragmatic view of what could be accomplished. And I would argue that realists have not been very evident since the end of the Cold War. The last, I think, really prominent realists in American foreign policy were, say, Brent Scowcroft and possibly Colin Powell. But I think since the end of the Cold War, it's been a sort of tacit alliance of neoconservatives and liberal interventionists who have been setting the tone for much of American foreign policy, and with rather unfortunate results.
Okay. So there's a lot there. The basic idea is it's a jungle out there. Do not be deceived. All these animals out there called nation states are going to act in their self-interest. And you presumably should, too, if you're a nation with a foreign policy. And so go at it with those assumptions in mind. Wow, a lot of places you could go. I would say, I think one thing that has come to be associated with realism that isn't part of the definition, but maybe because it's kind of consistent with it, is a fear of blowback or an alertness to the kind of unintended consequences of doing things for idealistic reasons.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's not a central part of the sort of coherent theory of realism, at least as academic realists write about it. But I think if you look at most of the people who would be considered realists in the foreign policy community today, most of them are very wary about ambitious programs for social engineering in far-flung countries that we don't understand very well. Mm-hmm. And it's for two main reasons, and you touched on them. One is that these vast projects are very unpredictable. It's hard to be confident that you're going to succeed, because re-engineering a foreign society is a very complicated process.
Don't you think the Iraq thing went pretty well, though?
Yeah, brilliantly. And all of the predictions before we went in have been borne out. Unfortunately, the predictions that have been borne out were by the ones who opposed it, because they anticipated what was likely to happen. Well, we've seen this in lots of other places. It's been true in our efforts to create a stable state in Afghanistan, certainly true following the Western intervention in Libya, that putting together workable societies is just very, very hard to do. And you can go in with really good intentions and things aren't likely to work out as you expect. Now, secondly, one of the ways they tend not to work as you expect is that you get what you referred to as blowback. I think it's a term that really was popularized most by Chalmers Johnson. And it refers to the idea that occasionally you go off and do things in other parts of the world, and some of the people you're doing them to don't like it very much. And at some point, they try and pay you back. They rebel, they oppose, they become terrorists or whatever. So you've gone off and done something somewhere, and 3 or 5 or 10 years later, you find yourself getting whacked by somebody, and you've forgotten what it was you did back then 10 years ago that is now leading to this reaction against you. And I think realists are sensitive to the fact that if you're very powerful and you use that power in lots of places, some of the people you're using it on aren't going to like it, and a few of them are going to find ways to make you pay a price.
It's like, oh yeah, we did sponsor a coup in Iran in 1953, come to think of it, didn't we?
Exactly. We did overthrow other governments in various places. We have armed a number of countries in the Middle East and elsewhere, and some of the people we've armed haven't used those weapons in particularly benevolent ways. We've backed governments that were deeply corrupt, etc. And all of those things, not all of them, but some of them will eventually come home to roost. The problem is we may have forgotten that we bore any responsibility for that, and we'll assume that the people who are doing these things to us are doing it just because they hate America, hate our values, or because they are inherently evil. And realists tend not to see it that way. They tend to see that we've had some role in some of the bad things that happened to us.
Mm-hmm. It's funny because a lot of times the kind of meddling that leads to the blowback was probably itself justified as realism, at least in the conventional sense. In other words, these people thought, hey, it's a tough world, right? I mean, a lot of these things, the coups, the assassinations, and so on, they were probably thinking of themselves as realists, at least in the everyday sense of the term, and as quite far from idealistic. It seems like a lot of the meddling during the Cold War was only idealistic in the sense of being justified by whatever the philosophical, you know, justification for the Cold War was, you know?
That's a very good point. And I think, you know, certainly most of the people who ran American foreign policy from 1945 right through to 1992 thought they were engaged in hard-nosed realpolitik. Mm-hmm. And some of what we did certainly was consistent with a realist point of view. The fact that we created these very successful balancing coalitions against the Soviet Union, the whole strategy of containment was very much a realist strategy and worked very well. And at the risk of oversimplifying, I'd argue that, in fact, the realist elements of American strategy were quite successful for the most part. It was the places where we, in my view, departed from realism, where we started worrying a lot about falling dominoes, which really isn't a realist idea, when we began to think that we could spread democracy in lots of different places where it had never existed, when we paid, I think, excessive attention to events in parts of the world that were not strategically vital, that didn't have vital resources or key strategic locations. Most of those activities didn't work out very well. Fortunately, the Soviet Union did even more dumb things and was weaker to begin with, so we ended up winning the Cold War.
Yeah. Afghanistan was a dumb thing where we kind of countered their dumb thing with another dumb thing. And well, who you could argue it either way. I mean, that's a complicated thing. But let me get to another point. So you said that realism assumes a world where the primary actors are nation states. And I was tempted to say, well, then it's a good thing with you that ISIS declared itself a state, or you would be totally flummoxed as to how to even think about it. And there is a serious point, which is that even now that it's calling itself a state, there still are all of these non-state actors like Al-Qaeda. Can realism accommodate those?
It doesn't fit neatly into, you know, sort of existing academic theories of realism, which, as you just pointed out, are very state oriented. I do think a realist perspective still gives you some purchase on that. Among other things, realism, it does sort of alert you to the fact that you may be generating some of the resistance that you face, whether it's resistance from states that you're beating up on, or resistance from groups in societies that you're beating up on. Secondly, realism reminds you that in fact, most states, regardless of their ideological orientation or their politics, tend to be rather wary about non-state actors that are trying to overthrow them. If we're thinking about ISIS, or what it now calls itself, the Islamic State, this is an organization that actually poses a potential danger to a lot of other countries, including some bedfellows who you might not normally expect to jump in bed together. So suddenly you're finding the United States wanting to talk to perhaps Iran about this problem. We are back cooperating with the Maliki government in Baghdad, I think somewhat reluctantly. I can even imagine circumstances where the Saudis and the Iranians, who are on opposite sides of the Sunni-Shia divide, decide that a really radical Sunni political movement in Iraq is really potential trouble for both of them, and maybe they should downgrade their current quarrel a little bit while they deal with this problem. Again, I think realism alerts you to that set of possibilities, that both states and non-state actors are ultimately self-interested, ultimately competing for power, and the key for statecraft is to try and take advantage of cleavages among your adversaries and bring together as many supporters as you can.
Mm-hmm. Does that emphasis on self-interest lead a realist to suspect that the ideology of these actors, states, whatever, tends to be malleable in the sense that, well, let's take a concrete example. I mean, there's a kind of essentialism in the way people look at groups and ideological movements and so on. Think groups like Hamas, groups like ISIS. There's the assumption that they're driven by an ideology that will never change, and that, well, you take it from here if this is making sense to you.
Yeah. No, I think one of the tenets of sort of a realist approach to politics is that, yes, people have ideological beliefs. Yes, they sometimes are willing to sacrifice a great deal to try and advance those beliefs. But they also live in a competitive environment. And all political actors generally have to make some choices and some compromises. They may only be temporary retreats. They may be temporary coalitions intended to advance a cause. But it's pretty rare that you find a truly sort of fanatical movement that refuses to compromise any of its principles at all. And most of those movements don't last very long for precisely that reason. So realists are mindful of the fact that in a competitive world, it tends to force actors to become somewhat more moderate over time and to engage in, at a minimum, tactical compromises, mm-hmm. and at a maximum is sort of strategic readjustments over time as well. And it seems to me what's interesting from what we can tell so far about ISIS now is that they have been this sort of odd mix of real pragmatism in certain ways and let's call it real extremism in some other ways. And you can even see some of the things they're doing, including what sounds like a wacky idea, declaring yourself the caliphate and declaring yourself the leader, declaring himself to be the caliph, is in sense of also a marketing ploy designed to attract some more supporters, to try and to put potential opponents sort of on the back foot ideologically as well. And so I think even in a case of an extreme movement like that, you see signs of tactical calculation and even willingness to compromise along the way.
Right. And I mean, one reason I asked this question about ISIS in particular is it seems to me there is almost an assumption in Washington, not just that this group must be stopped from expanding. Obviously, you would want to stop them from expanding at some point. You wouldn't want them to run the world. But that they need to be, you know, kind of that the existence of such a state would pose some kind of existential threat to somebody, perhaps including the United States. And it seems to me, I haven't seen much in the way of just doing a good, cool thought experiment, cool in the sense of detached and clinical, and saying, okay, let's suppose that things just stabilized and they had this state. I think it's already pretty clear it wouldn't include Baghdad, for example. Maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to me they're not all that far from the limits of their realistic aspirations, at least in the near term. So let's assume you had this state, and it was a state that has the usual problems of a state. They've got all these people that need to, you know, be fed and stuff, and they've got it, you know, the garbage has to be picked up and everything. Like, okay, how would they behave? How might that modify the behavior? And I'm not saying I know the answer, but it seems to me that most of Washington hasn't even gotten to the point of asking the question in a serious way.
I've seen a few commentaries kicking this around back and forth, but you're putting your finger on a really important issue, it seems to me. First point is there's, I think, a very powerful tendency in Washington to assume the worst about any political development happening anywhere, particularly if it involves people that we have good reasons not to be fond of or whose behavior we find objectionable. And it's very easy, because we're all very creative people, to imagine sort of nightmare scenarios by which either they just continue to spread in a wave across the Middle East, which I think is extremely unlikely, bordering on absurd, or to imagine scenarios, well, maybe they consolidate control, and then maybe they create a safe haven, and then maybe they attract some technologically sophisticated people to their banner, and maybe they're able to get some renegade Russian general to give them some nuclear material, and maybe they're able to steal a cruise missile from some Iranian sympathizer, et cetera, and next thing you know, they're firing it at an American aircraft.
Also assume they're crazy.
Right.
Which you would have to be crazy in the sense of wanting to die yourself, not just wanting to send martyrs to their deaths, but actually wanting to die yourself.
So I think, again, we can think up possibilities, and of course you can't disprove any of them. But I do think we should step back and be a little bit more clinical about this and say, first of all, if they are able to consolidate control over some area of former Iraq and former Syria, first of all, this is not an area that's brimming with resources. It has a little bit of oil, but not a lot of oil. It's not a technological hub. It's not a site of vast, sophisticated industries. It doesn't have an enormous number of people in it, etc. In other words, we're not thinking about a state that has suddenly recreated something like Nazi Germany or Imperial Japan or the former Soviet Union. It's not going to be as powerful as Saddam Hussein's Iraq was, and Saddam Hussein's Iraq was easily defeated not once but twice. So it's not going to be a really capable state. It might be, and repeat might here, be able to sponsor some acts of terrorism, almost certainly acts of conventional terrorism, and most of them likely to be centered in its immediate region. So it will be of concern to what's left of Iraq. It might be of concern to the Kurds, concern to the Turks, concern to Jordanians, but only at some remove mortal or serious concern to the United States. I think that's the place we ought to begin, is that this is not a good set of developments. But it is not 1938. It is not something that we should view as a direct and imminent threat to American security, and probably not to the security of most of our friends in the region.
Well, and there's also the fact that, you know, should it start sponsoring terrorism in a conspicuous way, it's not a very elusive target. I mean, one virtue of being an actual non-state actor is that you can, like, melt into the forest or the woodwork or something after you do your terrorism. Whereas this terrorism would have a return address. And it's not as if, you know, and moreover, it's basically, it would be starting off surrounded by enemies, essentially. I mean, the Sunni states, whatever assistance may have come from various players in a place like Saudi Arabia, surely the government of Saudi Arabia considers this movement a threat. And so, I mean, it's surrounded by enemies who know its return address, know the return address of any of the terrorism. It's hard for me to imagine the thing getting out of control, except possibly in the sense of triggering a war that it ultimately loses for sure.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, the other thing to remember is there have been a few other examples in history where in situations of statelessness or anarchy, when central governments have been very weak, that's been true now in Syria and Iraq since we invaded, where relatively small movements have been able to control or appear to control large amounts of territory, particularly territory that's sparsely populated to begin with. When you see these maps showing the area they control, that's true, but most of those areas aren't populated. It's that they control most of the key cities, some border control points, things like that. Their actual footprint of physical control is quite limited and can be done with a relatively small number of people. Some people have made the comparison to the Taliban and their ability to take over in Afghanistan in the 1990s, which was rather similar. A relatively small group of people by controlling a few key cities in a situation of great social dislocation where the other warlords had mismanaged things in a variety of ways, suddenly the Taliban were able to gain control. As we saw in 2002, 2003, however, the Taliban hold on Afghanistan was itself very brittle and very fragile. And I think it's more than likely that if ISIS really ever does get challenged, it may prove to be a rather evanescent phenomena. They were able to do really well in some pretty ideal conditions, but once they faced more serious challenges, some of the people who may have gone along with them begin to defect. People are disaffected by their rule. They may even have internal cleavages that we don't know about yet. Again, it's hard to see this as the sort of Bolshevik revolution that then suddenly leads to a 50 to 80 year struggle against world communism.
Mm-hmm. I guess if there was a threat that I kind of considered semi-plausible or at least, worth addressing, it would be like if I am one of these Sunni states like Saudi Arabia, one scenario that might worry me is not so much terrorism emanating directly and discernibly from that state as the power of inspiration emanating. In other words, these Sunni states have their disaffected people who don't like the authoritarian rule and may consider themselves jihadists or whatever. They're under control for now via, among other things, authoritarianism. But I guess I might worry that if this so-called caliphate seems to be flourishing, even kind of surviving, I might worry if I'm Saudi Arabia that ultimately nourishes what could become a successful revolt, and maybe it could. I assume that the hold on power of some of these authoritarian governments is in some sense a little fragile, the way it can be in authoritarian states.
Yeah, I think that would be a concern. It's the sort of standard worry about political contagion. And you will recall back when the Arab Spring began, some of us, myself included, were rather surprised by how quickly things began to reverberate, starting in Tunisia, then in Cairo, then in Syria, Libya, and a number of other places. Now, what's also interesting is people who were very optimistic in, say, 2010, 2011, that this was really going to sweep and encourage the emergence of pluralism within the Arab world, have, I think, now been disappointed by the backlash. The state struck back in Egypt. It has not resonated very much in Jordan or Saudi Arabia. Bahrain has cracked down. The evolution of events in Libya has certainly not been in a liberal or pluralistic direction that one could take much hope in. So I think people could look at ISIS and worry that it might prove to be a contagious example. But that sort of thing is pretty rare in world politics, that things really do spread. The potential targets have lots of things they can do to try and bolster themselves against it. And it's unlikely, it seems to me, that movement, if it, you know, even if it survives, is going to have such a track record of success 5 or 10 years from now that people in Saudi Arabia or even in places like Jordan, at large numbers, will say, oh, gee, we want to live like they're living. We want to have an experience like theirs. What I think is more likely is we're going to be seeing a series of experiments or variations on the role of Islam in politics, and it'll take a somewhat different form in each of these places, of which this is, again, sort of one scenario, of which maybe this new Islamic state in former Iraq and former Syria is one variation, but only one of many. Mm-hmm. And that's, by the way, completely speculative on my part.
Yeah, well, as it has to be. Speaking of the Arab Spring, here's a little kind of a curiosity or paradox that I haven't totally figured out, which is, I mean, first of all, I consider myself a kind of realist. I've called myself a progressive realist. And I know my view, I was supportive of the revolution in Egypt and very much against the coup and against America's, tacit acceptance of the coup, I guess I would say. And lately, you know, basically embrace of the coup. If I read your Twitter feed correctly, you share at least some of those sentiments, and you wouldn't really expect a realist on theoretical grounds necessarily to view things that way, right? I mean, I'm trying to figure out why I think I have an answer as to why I feel this way. But you might think that the realist position is, okay, you had the coup. You know, a government's a government as far as America's concerned. If they've got control, they're the guys they're dealing with, you know, and if they want to be friends, we want to be friends. So if I'm right that you're kind of skeptical of what America's policy toward the coup was, and maybe I'm wrong, how do you square that with your realism?
I agree there's a tension there, but I think one of the ways I've squared it in my own mind is it's one thing to sort of be actively supporting social upheaval in Egypt or actively supporting, you know, a greater turmoil. And it's another thing to sort of fully embrace a government that's clearly now both not listening very much to American advice, but also completely contrary to American values, whatever it is we claim to stand for. And I think a realist would say, look, we have our values. We want to see them advance, but we have to be pragmatic in this very competitive world. There may, however, be circumstances where what we really want to be is more detached in general. And that's where I come down on the Middle East right now. I think that whole region is in for a difficult series of decades as it deals with a whole series of social and political cleavages and conflicts that are probably going to get worse before they get better. And the United States has the great good fortune to be a long ways away from them and without any deep, vital strategic interest there. That's, by the way, particularly true as we become less and less dependent on energy from outside America's borders. Mm-hmm. Doesn't make energy of no concern, but it does diminish its importance for the United States to some degree. So the question I think that Americans are going to have to debate with respect to the Middle East is, are we likely to be better off keeping the region as much at arm's length as we can? Or are we likely to be better off being actively involved, trying to shape events, trying to decide who's going to be in power, backing different factions? And my sense is our track record over the last 15 or 20 years is actually quite poor in trying to do that sort of thing. And we'd be better off letting the region sort out most of its problems for itself and working in a sense with whoever wins. And I think we can get away with that because, again, none of these actors are especially powerful, or likely to pose a mortal threat to vital American security interests.
When you say work with whoever wins, you are making a distinction between working with them in the minimal sense and like actively showering them with military hardware.
That's right. So to take the Egyptian case, I thought that, Egypt did not face any national security problems for which additional tanks, armored personnel carriers, and fighter aircraft were really needed. What Egypt needs more than anything else is, you know, better education, less corruption, things like that. And if we're going to provide aid to Egypt, it shouldn't be in the form of military toys for the generals. It should be in things that might actually help them have a thriving economy and a more robust society overall. So the idea of just going back to the same old bribe that we've been giving them ever since the Camp David Accords struck me as unnecessary, and we had a perfect excuse for not doing that when they staged the coup.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's go back to Syria. A lot of people are saying that, well, ISIS wouldn't have become a threat if we had intervened in Syria early enough and gotten that situation under control somehow. Is your view that they're just wrong as a matter of fact, that we with any confidence could have gotten the situation under control? I mean, you grant presumably that this became something of an incubator for a group that, you know, we'd probably all just assume didn't exist.
That's right. But it's, I think, a wild assumption to assume that greater American involvement earlier on would reliably have produced a quick resolution to it. I think, again, we've seen in a number of other cases that it's easy to get involved in these places. It's just very hard to control the politics once you're involved. And once you're involved, you become targets for precisely the same sort of radical movements that we've seen emerge. So these various groups that were fighting against Assad would just as easily have begun to fight against an American or a European or an independent Arab force that intervened and tried to shape the politics there. As I think Obama has correctly understood all along, even providing weaponry to different factions didn't give you any leverage because you had no control over how the weapons were going to be used, who they might be sold to, who they might be seized by. And that therefore, staying out, although it has not solved the problem, seems to be made it any worse. And for the United States to have gotten involved again would not have guaranteed we'd be in a much better situation now.
Right. I mean, the other thing I'd say is that most of the people, I think, who were advocating intervention weren't advocating intervention of the most pragmatic sort. In other words, their goal wasn't to establish stability per se as soon as possible, even if that meant cutting a deal with Assad and giving him 3/4 of the country or something like that. They were basically people who favored regime change, and that's a much more ambitious order, and we have recent reason to believe it often doesn't work out well when we you know, both in Libya and Iraq.
I mean, right, and one thing we ought to remember is the United States could not control the evolution of Iraq's internal politics when we had 150,000-plus troops there, occupying the country, very capable forces, and yet what happened in Baghdad, what happened in the attempts to form a workable government there, what was happening out in the provinces was frequently evading our control and, of course, generating a great deal of popular opposition to the American presence, which is why ultimately first President Bush and then President Obama concluded that we really had no choice but to get out, and we did. This myth, I think, that Obama could have stayed longer, I think is wrong. The Iraqis, perhaps incorrectly, but the Iraqis wanted us out and we left. Now, if we couldn't manage Iraq's politics when we had a large occupying army there, we aren't going to be able to manage Syria's politics or Iraq's politics today with a handful of weapons, a handful of advisors, drones flying around taking pictures and maybe doing more. There are just real limits to what you can do sitting in Washington, D.C., and dispatching small amounts of military power in different places. Mm-hmm. You kill people, you just can't control the politics of a particular region. And as in Afghanistan, as in Iraq, as in elsewhere, ultimately it's going to be up to the people who live there. And perhaps at the margin, we may be able to help in various ways, but we want to be really humble about what we think we might be able to accomplish. And we want to be very mindful of the fact that the results may be quite the opposite of what we really intend or want. Mm-hmm.
Now, I think I heard you say that in Syria, Obama seemed to be mindful of the fact that when you get very involved in a place, you're one of the things you're doing is just directing fire toward yourself, you know, not just in the immediate sense, but in the long-term sense of where the jihadists decide the biggest enemy is. In the recent weeks in Iraq, I'm not sure I've seen the administration be quite as mindful of that as I might like. And I certainly haven't heard that much discussion of this in Washington. That, you know, I mean, first of all, Obama did send advisors immediately, which kind of did identify us with, for example, the assault on Tikrit. That was seen as, in some sense, an American-assisted operation. And I haven't heard many people, like when Russia says, well, we want to send our, you know, aircraft, you know, we want to beat you to the punch. I haven't heard many people in Washington say, well, fine, you become the far enemy of jihadism everywhere, right? I mean, I'm surprised by the lack of cynicism, am I wrong, or?
No, I think that, first of all, there's a deeply embedded tendency within the sort of Washington foreign policy world to assume that almost any problem in the world has to have a solution that's made in America. You know, this is best embodied in Madeleine Albright's famous line that the United States is the indispensable nation. And if you're a Washington policy wonk, that's the way you tend to look at almost any problem, that this problem ought to be solved by us first and foremost, or it won't get solved in the right way. An alternative way to think about it, and I think one that's more consistent with my sort of realist view, is that, boy, if you can get somebody else to take on some costly, difficult, intractable problem, that's smart. And you ought to save your wealth and save your power for when it really matters, when the wolf is really at the door, when you've really got to go find bin Laden, or when you've got to stop a Nazi Germany or a Soviet Union from invading Western Europe. And the rest of the time, you want to try and shove these burdens off onto others, particularly people in the region who have a much greater incentive to do it than you do. So in that sense, the impulse we constantly have to sort of send the, colloquially, to send the Marines, I think is an impulse we ought to resist. Mm-hmm. Difficulty is, if you're the American president, I think that's also a very difficult propensity, because you've got all these forces, you've got military is garrisoned around the world. If any problem happens anywhere, there's probably something you can do about it, right? And your advisors will come in and say, Mr. President, there's something really horrible happening to some unfortunate people, and there's that big red button on your desk, and if you press it, we can do something about it. Mm-hmm. Now, take an extraordinary discipline not to occasionally press that button. So even a president like Obama, who I think has very sensible instincts, nonetheless found himself getting involved in Libya, despite his initial inclination not to, has done, I think, more in Syria than he initially intended to, has got advisors heading back to Iraq, even though the mantra of his whole two terms has been, I got us out of Iraq. Until the United States learns that there are some problems, even in places we've been involved in the past, that we don't know how to solve and are as likely to make worse as to make better by getting involved, we're still going to find ourselves in situations we don't know how to control, and probably both increasing dangers to ourselves, but also certainly increasing costs.
Okay. And you said Obama seems sensible by your lights for the most part. Would you say that this common assessment that he's a realist at heart is accurate?
I tend not to use that to describe him. I think he has a certain, pragmatic view of foreign policy. He has a realistic sense of what U.S. power can and cannot accomplish. So in that sense, yes, I think he is sort of realist, cost-benefit, national interest kind of focus. I don't think he has a well thought through or clearly articulated sort of realist strategy, a set of, here's what are the most important objectives or priorities that I want to use to guide my foreign policy. And I don't, and he is occasionally prone to, succumb to the more idealistic, let's advance human rights, let's spread democracy, just like, the Bush administration and just like the Clinton administration. Again, that's pretty heavily wired into the foreign policy.
Well, he did choose Samantha Power as one of his guiding lights early on, right?
Yeah, she was an aide to him back when he was a senator. So I think he's has always had some, admirably idealistic notions. From my perspective, I wish though they were tempered occasionally by even more restraint than he's actually shown. Mm-hmm.
So on ISIS right now, would your recommendation that be that we do nothing in particular? Would you not have even sent the 300 advisors or however many people are over there now?
Yeah, I think I would have not. That's a very tricky call, because if in fact the Iraqi government can deal with this problem and do so relatively expeditiously, that's much better. The danger, of course, is that this isn't a success, and that then the question is, well, do you send 1,000 more? And we've seen that movie time and time again. I think it also put us in this sort of awkward position where we now see Maliki as part of the problem, that what has allowed ISIS to advance as rapidly as possible is the sectarianism that Maliki has displayed for months, if not years now, and how that's alienated much of the Sunni population that isn't really sympathetic to the ISIS agenda, but certainly is hostile to what Baghdad's doing. The problem for us is that we've now sort of re-embraced the Maliki government before they've altered their policies. And indeed, they can't even get a government formed out of the Iraqi parliament right now. I guess I would have liked to have seen the situation in Baghdad improve before the United States moved to embrace them yet again.
Yeah. Now, did you read this Steve Call piece in The New Yorker about how we should organize all the Sunni states to do something in Iraq?
Yeah. I think that has a sort of superficial appeal here. And certainly if ISIS does continue to develop and survive and maybe gain somewhat greater influence, that could be the glue of a coalition. The problem I see in it, first of all, is that a lot of these governments that we're rounding up are not particularly admirable and have a lot of their own problems. In fact, I think it's even possible to argue that there are no governments in the Middle East now who really are particularly consistent with American values. But by lining up the Sunni suspects, we are in effect taking a side in what is a much larger conflict between the Sunni and Shia world. And we would be throwing our lot in with one part of that. And again, it's a part of that grand civilizational cleavage that has some elements that we should be pretty uncomfortable with. That's where most of the al-Qaeda types have come from. That's where the money that has supported them mm-hmm. has come from. And I think if there are large cleavages running throughout the Middle East now on many fronts, Sunni, Shia, secular, sacred, Israeli, Palestinian, Hamas, Fatah, etc., that's not good, but it's not necessarily a disaster for the United States itself. Because, again, if you step back and ask what's the real core American interest here for, 50, 60 years, our central strategic interest in the region has been to make sure that no single hostile power dominated the whole place. Mm-hmm. We didn't want that to happen. We didn't want the Soviet Union to do it. We didn't want Nasser to do it. We didn't want Iran to do it. We didn't want Saddam Hussein to do it. Mm-hmm. At this point, given all the divisions within the region, the likelihood that any single power is going to exercise a dominant influence there is remote in the extreme. And from a realist point of view, that's actually not terrible from an American perspective.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I guess I'd also say, if the premise is right that all these Sunni states have an incentive to fight ISIS, they may not need all that much, leadership. I mean, maybe we could put them in touch with, you know, give them each other's phone numbers, you know, stuff like that.
Again, that this is the sort of classic American conceit that we know more about managing Middle East diplomacy than people in the Middle East do. I mean, certainly there's no shortage of money in that part of the world to run these sorts of things. All of these governments have had intelligence services that have intervened in various ways in each other's affairs. And the idea that we're going to sort of swoop in with a bunch of really astute and smart and wise Americans and just reorganize the politics in a clever way, I think is the kind of thinking that gets us into trouble.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe final question. If we could just move to Asia quickly, probably an easier place for a realist to think about, just a bunch of nation states. What are we doing right or wrong?
Well, I think that what we're doing right is we're recognizing that if you take the longer term view, right, what's happening in Asia is going to be of much greater consequence ultimately than what's happening in Iraq right now. That the rise of China is, in fact, a major strategic event, accompanied, I think, at a slower pace by the emergence of India and, of course, all the other Asian economies that have done remarkably well over the past 40 or 50 years. And we're also seeing now, quite evidently, why there's real potential for trouble there in the Chinese efforts to revise the territorial status quo in the South China and East China Sea, the hostility that's barely beneath the surface, if beneath the surface at all, between China and Japan. And I guess I would say two big things. First, I believe over time, the United States will devote more and more of its strategic attention to Asia. Obama has clearly wanted to do that, and I think his successors will follow that instinct as China continues to grow. And second, that managing a balancing coalition in Asia, which is what the United States is trying to do, although it's trying not to say it out loud, is going to be very tricky. It's going to be hard to keep that coalition together. These are countries that have close economic ties with China. These are countries that don't always get along particularly well with each other, especially true of Japan and South Korea. And they are countries that are, in some cases, vast distances from each other. If you think of, you know, India, Australia, Indonesia, Taiwan, Japan, Korea, there's a really large distance there, very different than NATO during the Cold War. So the big long-term diplomatic challenge for the United States, assuming China continues to grow, will be to manage a coalition of Asian friends and partners that's going to have lots of centrifugal tendencies and where the Chinese will have lots of ways to play sort of divide and conquer. And the way to connect these two conversations is to say that the more time, effort, and attention we spend worrying about things happening in the desert of Iraq, the less time, attention, effort we'll have to devote to what's happening in Asia. And I think that would be a mistake.
And then what do you do in Asia at these really dicey moments where China, you know, rams some Vietnamese fishing boat or actually takes over some rock, some island or something in seeming defiance of a reasonable understanding or in any event, in an aggressive manner? What does the U.S. do there? What should we do?
Well, I think there are two things. One is we want to continually reassert our commitment to freedom of navigation in the South China Sea and the position we've taken all along that however the territorial disputes there got resolved, it had to be resolved on a multilateral basis. And there we ought to be standing firmly behind the international law of the sea, and the mossbacks in our Senate should ratify it tomorrow. Something, by the way, that the U.S. Navy has been encouraging them to do for decades. This would give us, I think, somewhat greater legitimacy in pressing that position towards the Chinese. Mm-hmm. And I think over time, we're going to have to be willing to commit ourselves more strongly to a number of the countries in that region. The tricky part is to do that without then encouraging them to take on risks that we don't want them to take. And there is the danger, the sort of moral hazard problem, that if you back an ally too energetically, they begin to take steps you don't want them to take. Mm-hmm. And so part of the alliance management problem for us has been, it will be to give these allies enough support so they feel confident, mm-hmm. but not so much that they either free ride on American protection, let us all do all the real work, or engage in reckless behavior of their own and get us into trouble. Mm-hmm. And that's going to mean we need to spend a lot of attention there, have diplomats who really understand those countries, are very comfortable talking to their counterparts, and devote a lot of high-level attention at the White House as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Law of the Sea Treaty, you said at the outset, realism assumes, you know, no world government. Well, the Law of the Sea Treaty, I would say, is an example of kind of global governance, right?
Right.
And there are other such examples. I mean, the World Trade Organization now has an actual, you know, an adjudicatory function, and it can levy, you know, kind of not super strong penalties, but not trivial ones. It can authorize retaliatory measures and so on. And, you know, a little known fact is that, you know, Hans Morgenthau, who's, I don't know, either the founding father of realism or certainly one of them, in some book of his that I've got, which I think is a classic, whatever his classic book is called, he actually says, if there were a world government, realism could adapt. Realism is not, the core of the perspective is not incompatible with that.
I'm not sure I agree with his view on that. It certainly would remove some of the bite of political realism, although he had a sort of broader realist philosophy that did incorporate, you know, domestic politics in various ways. But Morgenthau, in that book, Politics Among Nations, has a chapter on international law. And realists, I think, are often caricatured as people who don't believe in international law, don't believe in international institutions. I think it's more accurate to say that realists see law and institutions as tools. They are tools of statecraft that countries use to advance their interests. So we help promote the World Trade Organization, and we abide by its decisions, even when it goes against us, because it's ultimately in our interest to have a set of rules governing the trading regime than it is to have no rules whatsoever. And because we're so powerful, we had a really big voice in writing a lot of those rules, too. Similarly, the Law of the Sea is something the U.S. Navy favors because we control the seas. We'd like to have rules that govern how others use it. We'd like to know where territorial waters begin and end. Mm-hmm. It makes it easier for us to operate. The final thing that realists would say is these rules are very useful. Institutions are valuable tools of statecraft, but they can't stop powerful countries from doing what they really feel they have to do or really want to do. It's especially true for a country as powerful as the United States. And in this case, the case of China and, say, the South China Sea, the international law of the sea is simply a tool we can use that gives a little bit more weight to our position that they really shouldn't be bullying all of their neighbors, that they should reach some general agreement.
But
it doesn't mean they're going to, but it might help a little bit, and it certainly makes us look less hypocritical.
Well, right, and speaking of that, if you're going to use it as an effective lever, it's going to be most effective if you actually abide by it yourself.
Correct.
And that's how the logic of national self-interest leads to what I would call global governance, can in principle lead to it. And there's no point at which the involvement of the nations departs from a rationale of self-interest necessarily. But you can still wind up with robust international institutions, including ones with punitive levers.
Right. I agree completely. And, you know, all one can think of a multiple sets of issues where this is the case, and generally sort of any issue where no single country can accomplish what it needs to or wants to accomplish entirely on its own. Mm-hmm. So climate change would be a perfect example of that. The global health regime would be another one. There's lots of places where, enlightened, self-interested states have understood that in order to get what they wanted, they were going to have to both reach agreements with others, but then that they would be better off writing those agreements down, turning them into an institutionalized set of rules.
Right.
the only thing a realist would, you know, always feel like they had to add is that, well, yeah, that's, those rules are really useful, but states will violate them if they have to, or if circumstances change, if the balance of power shifts in fundamental ways, you should expect to see those rules get rewritten in the interests of those who are more powerful.
Right. So if you like the rules, you might want to not violate them too much yourself. So there's a kind of a second realist critique of the Iraq War in principle, which is that if you think the United Nations is an effective institution, although it's, of course, a very weak one when it comes to the Security Council and enforcing the norm against transborder aggression, still, after the Cold War, it was starting to pick up a little steam. And you might say a realist critique, although it seems like realist in the conventional sense and cynical to say, screw the Security Council, we're invading Iraq, or screw the Security Council, we're going to abuse the mandate in Libya and go beyond protection right. of people and move toward regime change. There is a realist critique of those policies that says, no, it's in America's national self-interest to respect the rules of institutions it expects to use.
I think that's right, although to be honest, that's not a line of argument that most realists have used.
No, I know, and that's why I'm here, to show the way, Steve, in the modern world.
Thank you. I mean, the other thing that I think most realists would say is if you're going to violate the rules, I mean, there is this argument about sort of retrospective justification. If you're going to break all the rules and yet you keep achieving positive results, then you can retrospectively justify all of these things. So, you know, if Iraq had gone swimmingly, if the Iraqis were all living together happily in a lovely multi-party democracy, et cetera, then I could imagine neoconservatives say, you know, look, we were right to pay no attention to the Security Council. It's a useless institution, et cetera. What most of the realists I know would say, yes, but it didn't take a genius to figure out that this wasn't going to go very well, that you could break Iraq, right. You couldn't put it back together, and therefore to base your hopes or to justify violating international law in that fashion on the basis of post hoc justification was never going to fly very well.
Yeah. Now, it's an easier critique to just say, look, the war really didn't work out. Did it? Okay, well, listen, thank you. This has been a very efficient tour of the realist landscape.
Thank you. I'm sorry I don't have more optimism to offer. But again, if you're a realist, being optimistic is not usually part of the equation.
No, and I guess you would say that you'd be less pessimistic if the policies being exercised were all realist policies, right?
Yes, I would. I think that would be better for the United States and actually also better for most of the world, too.
Yeah, and that is we won't even get into the whole critique of realism as it being at best amoral or immoral, but I know there is a kind of response to that, and you've hinted at one of them right. just now. Okay. Well, okay. Thanks a lot, Steve.
Pleasure talking with you all, Bob. Always, Bob, and give me a call if you want to chat about something else.
Let's do it again.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right.